Hey, we've got a quorum. We're going to get going here. Oh. Welcome, members, and we do have a call meeting to order, Environment Natural Resource Policy. And I said we do have a quorum. So we've got some minutes from February 24th, 2020. I'm sure you've all read them. Anybody want to announce that they read them and move to approve? Representative Becker-Finn.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Becker-Finn moves approval of minutes for February 24, 2020. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved, February 24, 2020. First bill this evening is Representative Herr's bill, House File 3753. And I'll move that House File 3753 be brought before the committee. And welcome, and looks like you have a few testifiers. I move that House File 3753 be before us, and I'll move that House File 3753 be referred to the Environment Natural Resource Finance Division. So, Representative Herr, please tell us about your bill.
Yes, thank you, Chair Purcell and community members. Before you is House File 3753. It is a bill requiring analysis of certain demographic factors in permits and environment review documents. This bill does three things. It amends Section 116.07, Subdivision 4A, pertaining to just Hennepin County. That starts on page 1, starting on line 1.18. It adds a new subdivision, which starts on page 2, line 2.27, and that outlines the demographic analysis. And the last change is this bill amends Subdivision 2C to require it amends the bill Subdivision 2C to require all EAWs or environmental assessment worksheets and EIS environmental impact statements to complete the demographic analysis. Oh, and before I continue, I just want to say I did check in with Chair Purcell, and he said that I didn't have to bring you guys treats, so I didn't bring treats today, okay? I hope that doesn't impact your voting at the end of this bill. So before I introduce my testifiers, I just want to say a few words because this bill, I know that it's very new, and there are things that we're asking that maybe traditionally haven't been done before. And as a new legislator with a policy background and experience in operations, I see how sometimes policy is made without thought as to how statutes will be operationalized. I also see how those working in, who do the operationalization of some of this work resist new processes as a result of change in state statute. This happens regardless of which party is in the majority or who is appointed to lead our departments. I say this because I want to acknowledge the hard work of the people who show up day after day to do their jobs. Legislators don't pass laws to make it hard on departments and agencies, and people who work in departments and agencies don't resist change just to resist change. I do believe that employees show up every day doing the best that they can within the structures we have given them. These structures are shaped by formal laws we have put into place and informal laws, which is more commonly known as socialization, which create norms in work culture and workplace cultures, but put into place long before any of the people who do this work actually got here. And so I just wanted to make sure that I said that, because I don't ever want a bill to look like we're doing something without being thoughtful about the whole system and how it all interacts together. And the objective with this bill is not to dictate the execution of processes, but to change the structures that we operate within. The greatest impact of this bill will be on the MPCA, and I want to just acknowledge the great work that their employees and their departments do. And I just want to say that right off the bat that we are actually continually working with MPCA on this particular bill, that there could be changes as this goes through the process. And we have other partners who have been working with us as well. And so I just sort of wanted to lay the stage for that to say that we have collaboratively been working together, and it's been a really good working relationship. And so with that, I just want to make sure, and I think that I'm sure that this committee is very well aware of environmental justice, climate justice work. But I just wanted to repeat the definition that before I have my first testifier, Marco, testify. So I just want to read the definition that environmental justice is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. Fair treatment means that no population bears a disproportionate share of negative environmental consequences resulting from industrial, municipal, and commercial operations, or from the execution of federal, state, and local laws, regulations, and policies. Meaningful involvement requires effective access to decision makers for all and the ability in all communities to make informed decisions and take positive actions to produce environmental justice for themselves. With that, Chair, with your permission, I would like to introduce my first testifier, Marco, and he, if that's okay.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
All right. Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marco Hernandez, an environmental justice organizer for COPAL, Communities Organizing for Latino Power in Action, and thank you so much for having me here on such a Super Tuesday. Thank you so much, Representative Kerr, for pushing this bill, because this is literally the time when we need to actively find solutions towards the climate crisis. Everybody's affected by the climate crisis, but due to institutional and historical discrimination, some communities are impacted more than others. And so before I continue, I would like to give a definition of cumulative impact, because I know there's people out there, including myself before, I researched on this bill. I did not know the definition. So it means exposure, public health or environmental effects from the combined emissions and discharges in a geographic area, including environmental pollution from all sources, whether single or multimedia, routinely, accidentally, or otherwise released. Impacts will take into account sensitive populations and socioeconomic factors where applicable and to the extent data are available. So I would like to offer an example. The Herc trash incinerator in Minneapolis is in an area where mostly people of color live, and also where dozens of schools are within a few miles of the incinerator. NOC, or Neighborhoods Organizing for Change, conducted a survey many years ago asking people in the near north neighborhood about their health issues. And out of the 130 people they surveyed, 99% responded that they had or knew someone who has asthma. With the cumulative impact statement, the state would know the statistics of health disparities in the surrounding community, and the MPCA would have more information in order to come to a truly educated decision when it comes to approving and renewing permits. And so this isn't the first time that we're introducing a cumulative impact statement for the state. I have here the New Jersey bill as well as the federal bill New Jersey Senator Cory Booker is planning on drafting too. And so there is similar work being done at the federal level and in the other state. And so the environmental justice bill that Senator Booker introduced was one that several environmental justice organizers from across the country worked on with the senator's office. It is model legislation that can be used in the drafting of the EJ bill from Minnesota, as well as the New Jersey bill that we have here. An important step towards environmental justice is to see how these pollutant-emitting facilities are affecting Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and people of lower socioeconomic backgrounds. To dismantle the climate crisis, good policy and any resulting legislation must center frontline communities and their liberation. And so some people may say this is just added on red tape towards the economic well-being of the state. Without any protections towards the environment and the health of frontline communities of the state, the future of the state's economic, cultural, and environmental prosperity would be at stake. And so the state of Minnesota needs to raise concerns on environmental injustices towards frontline communities. And so in a nutshell, we all do better when we all do better. Thank you. Now I'd like to pass it on to my colleague right over here.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Thank you. Chairman Purcell and members of the committee, my name is Soraya Williams and I am the legal fellow for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, or MCEA. MCEA is a public interest nonprofit law firm and advocacy organization that has defended Minnesota's environment using law and science since 1974. Today I'm here to express support for House Number 3753. At MCEA, we understand that in order to preserve Minnesota's environment, we must not forget the human component. We believe that this proposed bill continues a conversation about the impacts permitted facilities have on communities throughout Minnesota. It continues a conversation that we need to keep in mind to provide environmental justice throughout Minnesota. Permitted facilities that emit toxins, even within permitted standards, have a massive, invasive presence in the communities they are among. The impacts of these facilities have the ability to influence every aspect of the surrounding community's livelihood, from their air and water to even their health insurance and housing. Incorporating a demographic analysis would provide permitting bodies a better understanding of the potential consequences granting a permit may have on a community. We must recognize that factors like race, ethnicity, income, and education should be taken into consideration when granting a permit. Minorities, low-income families, and individuals with limited access to education are impacted disproportionately by pollution from permitted facilities. Also, the presence of multiple permitted facilities within a community has significant environmental impacts, and biomonitoring and cumulative effects analyses can help demonstrate how significant those impacts are. These are just a few factors that permitting bodies should consider when determining whether a permitted facility should receive their permit in the first place at a certain location. Minnesota Statute 11607 provides guidelines for permitting by the Pollution Control Agency. It states how the PCA should navigate the process when issuing, amending, and renewing a permitted facility. The amendment would give the PCA better tools to protect Minnesota's environment and the health of its people when granting a permit. Minnesota Statute 116D.04 provides guidelines for the environmental assessment worksheets and environmental impact statements. Whenever a project or government action has the potential for significant environmental effects, these analyses are required. EAWs and EISs have elements of the demographic analysis already. And this proposed amendment would require appropriate government units to include more information about a population that may be exposed to the impacts of a proposed project before final approval. Overall, MCEA supports the need for a more detailed analysis of the impacts of a permanent facility within a community. We believe this amendment is a step in the right direction protecting Minnesotans and the environment. Thank you, Representative Herr, for your efforts on this bill. Once again, thank you, Chairman Parcell and the committee for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, and I'm gonna ask if there are any other testifiers on this bill. Anybody in the audience looking to testify on this bill? Don't see anybody coming up. Oh, here we go. I guess I didn't holler loud enough. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry about that. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify on House File 3753. Mr. Chairman, the goal of this bill is all about environmental justice. And the MPCA began working on environmental justice issues several years ago. We have an Environmental Justice Advisory Committee that advises the commissioner. We have an environmental justice framework that we instituted in 2013, I believe, and are now updating. So, Mr. Chairman, I have met with the author about this bill. We are currently reviewing this bill and working on the fiscal note. This bill does impact agencies beyond the MPCA, and that would come through line 4.6 through 4.8, because the demographic analysis laid out in this bill is required for all environmental review in the state, so environmental impact statements and environmental assessment worksheets. And then it would also apply to our permit issuance, permit renewals, and major amendments to permits. So a lot of these are new requirements and data that we don't necessarily collect, but I'm sure it's out there. And we will need to research, you know, where would be the source of this data that we would put together. As I said, we're working on our fiscal note. And Mr. Chairman, I think at this point, we're not taking a position on any bills with fiscal impact because the governor's budget is not out yet. But with that, I can say that we share the goal of environmental justice, and we're still looking at this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. I see. Let me ask one more time. Anybody else in the audience is looking to testify? I don't see anybody. I have Representative Anderson on the list for question, and then Representative Green, I saw you, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the bill author. I assume this, but this bill, if it becomes law, would be effective statewide. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, out where I live, I haul corn to an ethanol plant, and thinking about the location, it's about a mile out of town, and I can't think of any homes, anybody living within that mile radius of the ethanol plant. And just asking if you think a demographic, social, economic study of that population would be necessary in a situation like that when they are applying to renew their air permit, for example.
Representative Hur.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a really great question. I actually had that conversation with MPCA about potentially looking at, because that's really the operationalization of this statute. And to talk about, you know, is there ways that we can actually look at when they operationalize it as projects that prioritize that are near areas that could potentially have higher concentrations of communities of color or those from low-income community. And so those are some of the details that we'll be working out and kind of working with them on what we can do to make it something that's feasible.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could the MPCA come back down?
Welcome back, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you tell me how many permits the MPCA does in a year? Just the MPCA, of course, don't expect you to answer for the rest, but say EAWs, EISs, and other permits. How many do you do a year?
Commissioner Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe we have about 18,000 permits out there at any one time. I will need to get back to you with the number we do in a year, because some of them, especially the air permits, are non-expiring, although we do have to make major amendments to those. Other permits, many of our water permits are five-year permits. Some of our other permits are 10-year permits. So it would depend on, we're doing, you know, subsets of those. And then a lot of our permits, a good chunk of them, are construction stormwater. So those are the permits we give to construction projects every year. But I will get that number for the committee, Mr. Chairman. I don't have it at my fingertips.
Please get it back to us if you would.
Yep.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then in the past, I mean, has this been a problem? Has the MPCA done less when renewing permits in different areas of the state? And so now you have to be told to do more in certain areas or among different racial groups or different areas? Because it looks like it's blanketed across the state, and the bill almost suggests that the MPCA hasn't really been doing a good job in evaluating these permits. Is that, what is your response?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, that's a good question. As Representative Hurst said, we have met and talked about scoping for this bill, and that would be an option that we'd be more than happy to discuss. I think that many people believe we do not do a good enough job at this. I will say that our current permitting system, which a lot of our work, as you know, falls under federal law, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Superfund, et cetera. A lot of those federal laws have not been updated to include environmental justice concerns. So I think you asked, I think we try to do as good a job we can all the time, and our folks work very hard and care about what they do and try to put in a good day's work every single day. I would say the depth of information here is not something we have been collecting up to this point for our permits.
Representative Hurd, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman,
I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry. One other thing, though. If there is an environmental impact statement for a new project, for example, so in environmental review is two levels, the environmental assessment, which is the shorter kind of 20 questions form, and then the environmental impact statement, which is much more in-depth. So for the environmental impact statement, we probably do pick up several of these requirements that are laid out in Section 2 of the bill. Probably I can point out some of them. I don't think we're looking at the incidence of poor nutrition or some of those types of things, but we are looking at other information about proximity to residential areas and so forth. So I think when we do have an environmental impact statement, we're doing some of this work, but not all of what's laid out in this bill.
Representative Herr.
Chair Purcell, Representative Anderson, and I just want to maybe take a stab at your question, because I just want to remind people that this is only my second year, my first term. I've not been here long enough to form opinions about what I think if people are doing a good job or not a good job. The reason why, as I mentioned at the beginning of my opening testimony, is that I acknowledge that I think people show up every day doing the best job that they can, and they operate within the structures that we've created for them. And so if they're operating from a lens that is not looking at justice, environmental justice from that lens, it's not their fault. It's that we've created a structure that says that they don't have to actually consider that. And my goal with this bill is to actually say, I know you are all doing a really great job. You're doing the best that you can. And I want to give you new structures in which you look at and the lens of which you do your work. And so this has no judgment. This bill actually doesn't make any judgment on anybody or any work that's been done. It's really just saying we want to create a new structure that helps you look at this. And the truth is I actually spent quite a bit of time looking at MPCA's website, and I was really impressed. I looked at every single dot of, like, where every single, and I had no idea that they had to permit so many different things. Like, when I looked just in my neighborhood, I had to zoom into the street level because the dots were everywhere. That tells me that their intention, they're trying to do their best. And I'm just giving them some guidelines to say, hey, in the past, we might not have always thought about, you know, who was being directly impacted by some of these things. And I was thinking, as I was looking at their website, how wonderful that if we did do this kind of assessment, that they already have areas that show me where people of color are, where people in poverty are, what neighborhoods and sites are in those areas. Wouldn't that just be really great if they could add one more tab and say, this is the demographic impact of that? And maybe nothing gets done with that now, but we know that that information somebody is looking at. And my hope is to make those kinds of structural changes so that that means every project we look at, we see who that impacts and how that impacts. And so this is not a judgment at all at MPCA or any of our permitting agencies. This is just saying, I want to help you give a new structure of how we look at this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, your goal is admirable, but when you blanket across the state the way that you're doing here, and, you know, you're looking at 18,000 permits plus just for the MPCA, this is gonna waterlog the permit process. If you're familiar with the permit process now, it already can take years sometimes to get a permit, and depending on where you're at. And if this goes into effect, my guess is that people will just no longer seek permits or just leave the state again, because we're already at a point in Minnesota where we've permitted people out of our state. And so, you know, you're gonna do permits for air quality and stormwater permits at the same time, and they're all gonna have the same guidelines. It's gonna be astronomical. It is. I wait to see the fiscal note on this. It's gonna be crazy.
Representative Herr.
Chair Purcell, Representative Anderson, I appreciate your thoughts on this. I did hear about what the preliminary dollar amount for the fiscal note is, and I know we're not going to have that discussion here because it will go there, and it is big. And I would expect that it should be big, because Minnesota hasn't done a good job of looking at equity in the lens of when we look at environmental work. And so we're going to have to catch up on hundreds of years of not caring about certain communities. So it will cost us a lot of money, and I'm in a position to say I will ask for that money because it's important to do. And I just want to give one small analogy, because I know you mentioned that we're going to, people won't seek permits and they'll no longer work here. And I just want to say that, I don't know if you know this, but my background is in finance. I have an MBA. I studied market efficiencies. I studied economics, and that Minnesota is a great place to do business, and permitting is not going to stop people from doing work here. That would be the same analogy as if I said that, well, we don't have good laws around black and brown people and the treatment we get every day, and if we don't put those laws into place, black and brown people won't live here. But we live here. We still live here because there are other driving factors in which why people choose to have businesses in Minnesota and why they choose to live here in Minnesota. So I have every hope and faith in the goodness of Minnesotans and the environment we have created that people will continue on to do business here because we have great education, regardless of the disparities that we see in that. We still have good education. We have good opportunities. And so my hope is that, and I just want to address one more thing about the 18,000 permits. Those don't get reviewed all at the exact same time. So there's 18,000 permits, but they're not reviewing 18,000 permits at the same time. And when I talked to the commissioner, I sort of liken this to the fact that some of these projects are really small. And I really did think long and hard about, do we exempt really small businesses, really small projects, right? Because it doesn't make sense. And when I started thinking about this to myself, I thought, this is kind of like I experience microaggressions every single day. They seem really small, and they seem like they don't matter. Through the course of my lifetime, those microaggressions add up to something really, really big that has mental health consequences to me, have social impacts, have all of these consequences that are detrimental to society. I look at these projects in the same way. In itself, that project seems really, really small, and maybe we shouldn't spend the money and we shouldn't address that what that project is. But through the course of our state and our projects, when you add those up for decade after decade after decade, it makes huge, significant impact on our environment and the people who live within those neighborhoods in which these projects are have been put into those neighborhoods. And so, yes, I know that this bill, there's a lot that we have to think through, but I'm really willing to work with all of our partners. Because like having to address with the racial disparity, the racial issues and the microaggressions, the racism in our state, we have to do that and look at how that is showing up in the processes that we have within our state as well. And I, as an optimist, am willing to do that with all of my partners, with all of the legislators and everyone else in this room who is on board with the idea of what we want to do with this.
I have Representative Look.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for the bill author, Would this apply to all the local EAWs that local units of government do on a fairly frequent basis for, as you mentioned, very, very small local projects?
Chair, Representative
Herb.
At the current time, the way the bill is written is yes, but like I said, I am willing to work with the with our commissioner over here on figuring out what would make sense to operationalize something like this. And I've also talked with the advocates and the partners who said they're all very open to seeing what we can do to adjust this as well. So thank you for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this would probably be questions for MPCA. Do we right now have anything relative to ideal age distribution relative to granting a permit for the local community? I mean, I'm looking, and I'm in page 3 here, 3-1 through lines 3-8. We got actually 6 big things right there at the top, and each one of them, but right away, the age distribution, do we have a standard that we could apply when we ask an EAW question at the local level? What should be the proper age distribution for a community relative to, you know, having a waste treatment plant in their little city?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lewick, not to my knowledge. I don't think we have that.
Representative Lewick.
Another follow-up, how about birth rates? And I'll give you an example. My dad had 11 brothers and sisters, and I had a brother and two sisters, and we've got 2 children. And I don't know how many kids they're going to have, but do we have a kind of a standard we would apply to a permit that would be a good, bad, no-go for birth rate in the community?
Commissioner, that might be a trick question. I don't know, but go for it.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lewick, so our permits are based on state and federal law. State and federal law, for example, for air permits, look at the potential to emit. What is the emission coming out of that? Mm-hmm. For our water permits, we look at the discharge, and we also look at the receiving water. For our solid waste permits, we look at factors associated with landfills and so forth. I don't believe we have a criteria in state or federal law that requires us to look at birth rate or age distribution.
I guess, and then I'll go to line 3.9 through 3.11, where there's a, you know, significant list of medical issues there, and are our current standards, assuming they're enforced properly, are they supposed to, at best, hold these people harmless that would have all these different situations? In other words, and I'm going to make the assumption that they're going by the rules and there's no excess air pollution issued beyond the permit, no water contamination. Do the current standards, do we need to develop a second set of standards for these people? When you got three lines of very specific health-related diseases, some of them chronic, some of them could be very acute. You know.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lewick, I will say that I don't believe we do, but a lot of this information here sometimes comes into play. The health department does a lot mm-hmm. of work around these issues. They have been doing health impact analyses. I know they're very concerned and working very hard on high levels, high blood lead concentrations. Mm-hmm. For example, in our Water Gremlin recent investigation on an air permit violation, there was also knowledge uncovered that there had been some blood lead issues there too. So I think those issues can come to the fore mm-hmm. from time to time. But when we are issuing a permit or reissuing a permit or doing permits, I don't believe we look at these factors.
Yeah, Mr. And I appreciate that, and I think I would don't want to put words in the office mouth, but I suspect that, unfortunately, sometimes we find out lead concentrations that probably shouldn't be there after the fact. On the other hand, diabetes is, you know, that there's a variety of other medical issues here that are all over the place. From the standpoint of what could have caused, some could be hereditary, some could just be, you know, it's your time, or you start talking about pulmonary disease. So I'd say that this, I can appreciate, we want to make sure we're not creating these things. But on the other hand, for a brand new permit, do we have the standards that we think we could prevent these in the future? Right now, I'd suggest that we probably not a lot of work that we need to do in that area, because it basically assumes that all those standards are inadequate, or at least not all of them. But it strikes me that we got a set of standards, and we know they're not perfect. There's no question about that. But we're in a circumstance here. Is even MPCA the right folks to be trying to predict? Based on issuing a permit or denying a permit, whether or not this is going to have an impact on diabetes in the community, cancer, asthma. I mean, we know it can if it's not followed properly. But I'm just looking for here's the issue I have is that I don't think this bill is even ready yet to go to finance, because I don't know how you put your arms around that from a standpoint of coming up with a legitimate fiscal note as to what this would cost the state, let alone the local units of government. There's a question in there somewheres.
Representative Luke, let me just little bit on some of these. I'll just go with line 3.9. I haven't done some work on human health issues at a Superfund site. There are clusters, and I think that's what is being trying to be identified here, clusters of cancer, clusters of kidney disease, that kind of a thing. Representative Hurst said, there's certainly room to add or subtract words here from the bill at some point, but that's my take on it anyway. And alluding to the birth rate, a lot of times that comes in that, well, there's complications often if there's particularly the mother's being exposed to harmful chemicals, and we see high incidence of miscarriages, for instance. So those are things that are commonly looked at in those people who may be exposed to cancer-causing agents or endocrine disruptors, those kind of things. So, like Agent Orange comes to mind, Navy guy, yeah.
Yeah, I understand, appreciate that, Mr. Chair, but this looks like we're going to try to predict that into the future on a population that may or may not have those pockets.
I think
looking at the baseline here, and I guess, and this is, I'm curious on, I've got a couple more quick questions.
Okay, go ahead.
3.18 and maybe the, and 3.19, maybe the author can enlighten us. There's a comment about subsistent fishers and hunters may be exposed to chemicals. Are we talking about folks that just harvest fish and hunt in general, or a specific group of folks that would only rely on that for food subsistence?
Representative
Chair Purcell and Representative. So I just want to remind the committee that this isn't asking for those asking for parents to predict these things. This mm-hmm. is to collect, because we already know, the state already collects birth information, so we mm-hmm. know what birth rates are. Mm-hmm. We're not asking the company asking the parent to predict that. We're not asking them to predict incidence of respiratory disease or pulmonary. We already collect a lot of this information as a state. So when somebody is going to put a facility in a place, we just want them to know who is impacted by the facility that they're putting into there. And so this is really just saying, just lay out this information. And this information, we haven't stated in this bill if it's going to be used to deny permits or to not deny permits, or how, if it's going to be used to find somebody. It's none of that. All it is saying, if you're going to do a project, in addition to all the other things that we ask you to, like, collect and tell us how much you're going to emit in pollutions and whatever it might be, also collect this stuff so that you as a company, you know, because I suspect that if companies knew that if they were disproportionately hurting poor people and black and brown indigenous people, I don't think that's their intention either. And maybe by them going through this process, they will see, oh, you know what, when I do this, I'm actually really near tribal lands in which people there hunt and fish, and they actually live. They're not trophy fishing, they're not trophy hunting, so that people are consuming the animals. So this is really to provide information for people to know. And not only will it help the company, who I know probably really wants to be socially responsible, it also helps the community, so that since all of this information, the MPC already has so much public information out there, for us to teach people to empower themselves to say, hey, you can actually go out there and see who's in your area doing what. And this is the demographic, and this is where you live, and this is how it's impacting you. So really, it's a tool to help both the company that is trying to get a permit and the people who live in the area. So it's really serving a dual purpose. It's not blaming anybody. It's not asking people to collect new data that hasn't been collected. It's not asking people to predict anything. It is just gathering information that already exists. And
members are going to have to keep moving forward here. Commissioner, did you have something quick?
Yes, please? Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I just got some information. I had sent an email to the Department of Health. It looks like they're saying much of this data, not all of it, could come from the U.S. Census American Community mm-hmm. Survey, and also at the Department of Health. So there are sources out there, and I just wanted to share that information.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is mostly going to be a comment, but So this is the policy committee, and so, you know, sometimes it's hard in our heads to separate the finance part from the policy part, but I'm going to try to stick to the policy part. And really, I think your bill and some of the other bills that we've had regarding permitting are kind of, what we're trying to get at is what factors do we as a state take into account when we choose whether or not to allow a private industry to pollute our air, our water, our soil? Because it's really, our air and our water belong to all of us, and it's not your right to pollute those things. It's something that you're permitted to do within a measurable range. And so that's what we're dealing with. And I think what you're getting at with this bill that I really like is that we're finally starting to focus on who we choose to take into account and who in our community matters when we're looking at giving permits for who gets to pollute our air, our water, our soil. And I just want to clarify with House Research. So the language that's being, and for the public's knowledge too, so on line 1.18 in that section, so currently sort of the factors that we consider light that's currently in statute, that only applies to the city of Minneapolis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, it applies to a small part of the city of Minneapolis. It applies essentially to a district that was represented by Karen Clark when she was here, because she was the representative who sponsored the bill that got this language into law probably 10 or more years ago. And the reason it's being stricken is that this concept is now applying statewide.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I wanted to clarify that, because that means that essentially none of our constituents, maybe I guess Representative Gomez's constituents, are currently have this additional protection, but none of the rest of our constituents do. And I guess I'm not okay with that, with some Minnesotans' health being protected more than others. So I'm really glad that it's statewide, because whether you're someone who lives off of your venison and your fish up in the Leech Lake area, and we've had a Superfund site there for decades, and I certainly hope that that would be taken into account if there's some other permit within our water, within that watershed that's being looked at. And I would think whether, no matter what race you are, that if you're living off of eating a lot of fish, you should care about that a lot. You know, or if it's the city of Bemidji with their drinking water pollution, and we don't know what extent to the folks in my area in Gem Lake around Water Gremlin, we're not going to be able to prove probably how many of them have disorders and medical conditions because of that pollution. Not everything is mesothelioma, and not everything is that clear point A to point B. And so this seems like, I get that there's like a financial piece that this would be expensive to roll out if you were going to roll it out on every single permit, but we have to start having these conversations, because otherwise it isn't right that some communities are more protected than others. We should be protecting all of our communities and all of our constituents. And so I think it's great that it's statewide, and I think whether you live in rural Minnesota or suburban Minnesota or urban Minnesota, you should want to protect your constituents from this pollution. So I thank you for bringing this forward. I'm excited to be signed on to it and glad we're having this conversation.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's my thoughts and questions have kind of been answered, but I just want to verify 4.6 to 4.8. As a suburban county, I've seen many, many EAWs and EISs be done. So will this apply to those being done by counties as well as the state, et cetera, and then what's done with the new data that's being gathered? Those EAWs I've seen done are very detailed, and they don't look at who lives nearby. They want to see the impact and determine the impact no matter who lives there. And so I'm wondering what specific things or what special things will be done based on the data here versus what's already been gathered.
I've been her.
Chair, Representative Bowe, thank you for the question. So the way the language, as I mentioned earlier, is written now, it would be for every project, and we are open to having discussions with our partners to figure out what might be the best way to do this. Again, as a person who used to execute on operations in organizations and companies, I don't want to be as prescriptive as to tell somebody you know, every little detail of how to do this, but I want to work with my partners to give guidelines as to how we might want to execute this. So I appreciate your comment. The other thing is that what will we do with this data? That's a really good question. I actually thought a lot about this. I only got 2 hours of sleep last night because this was what kept me up last night, is really to say, what do we want to do with all this now? And my feeling has always been that if we're not even collecting the data, we won't know what the data is telling us to do with the information. So my hope is that we're collecting this data, and then I will work with our partners and agencies to say, how do we use this data to inform what it is that our next steps are? Do we post it? Is it that we want to make it public? Is it that we want to use it to influence the permitting process? Is it just that we want communities to know to feel empowered so that they could actually work with the company that's asking for permitting? So I don't actually know exactly, and I'm not that prescriptive yet at this point. I don't want to be, and so I really want to figure out where the data leads us and what we can do with the information. So I appreciate your question.
Representative Fabian. Okay. Any other comments, questions? Representative Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a comment for the author. You know, one of the things, and I don't know, there's nobody here from the health department, but it would seem that we need to be talking to them directly to fully understand what they already collect. There's some other folks, all the cities, not just the metro area here, you might want to pull the dipstick, so to speak, from those folks. They're hanging around the Capitol all the time, and they probably got an opinion. They deal with the EAWs on a very frequent basis. And another one is the counties. The counties, same thing. They manage huge amounts of land, as well as issue all kinds of permits. And so those are just other stakeholders that I would counsel that you want to send them this and say, what do you think? You know, what can work and what may not work. And you say that's why my concern is that it, I'm not sure where we'd get if we send it to finance and then we try to do a physical note on something that I think we just need to do a lot more work on. So that's it in a nutshell. We want to protect everybody, make sure that we maintain best health possible out there.
Thank you, Representative Lloyd. Closing comments, Representative Herr.
Chair Purcell, thank you so much for letting me come in front of this committee. Members, I appreciate the discussion today. I mean, we're trying to change structures that have been in place since the beginning of our country, and we have made incremental changes in trying to do right by the environment and by people, but we have a long ways to go, and I appreciate the additional thoughts around this. I will absolutely make an effort to work with cities and counties. I continue to work with our partners who are doing the permitting and also with our advocates so that we come to a place where we can say this is the beginning and we're going to continue to build from this as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to come in front of all of you, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Hearing no further discussion, I renew my motion to refer House File 3753 to Environment Natural Resource Finance Division. You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. The bill is going to Environment Finance. Thank you. And our next bill is the Sandell bill, House File 3423. In your seat, Representative Sandell, I'm going to move that House File 3423 be passed and referred to the Water Division. Tell us about your bill, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Purcell and members, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here tonight to talk with you about establishing water quality standards in Minnesota for the forever chemicals, PFOS and PFAS. I hope we can encourage you to support House File 3423 and take an important step toward public health.
Representative Sandell, can I interrupt you? I apologize.
You may.
Would you move the A1 amendment?
Oh,
let's get
you.
That done.
I do move the A1 amendment and hope that...
I'm sorry. I'm advised I need to move the amendment. So my apologies.
Follow directions.
So I'll move the A1 amendment, put the bill in form of the author once. Motion before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank
now,
you.
Please proceed.
Well, I learned about PFAS for the first time in 2007. When I received a letter from the Department of Health at my home in Woodbury suggesting that I have my well tested for PFAS contamination. Since then, the issue has grown in our collective attention and concern. The science of detection has become more sophisticated and our understanding of the chemical much more precise. This committee and others have heard about the economic, the political, and in fact the emotional impact of PFAS and PFOS. We may be talking about Minnesota tonight, but the presence of this chemical is ubiquitous and its suspected harm to the immune system, its effect on developmental toxicity, the possibility of increasing the risk of cancers, and the broad series of health concerns make our attention to this issue imperative. I've asked Mr. Aaron Klemps of the MCEA to be with me tonight. He's more able to describe the ecological dimensions of the problems we face and the reason it's so important to expedite our work on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Clemens, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Klemms, and I'm the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy's Director of Public Engagement. As you heard from Soraya Williams earlier, we're a nonprofit organization that's worked for nearly 50 years to protect Minnesota's environment and the health of its people. And that's the reason why we strongly support Representative Sandell's bill to appropriate money to adopt rules establishing water quality standards for PFOA and PFOS, two of the perfluorochemicals that have been detected in an increasing number of Minnesota's lakes, rivers, and streams, and in the groundwater that tens of thousands of Minnesotans drink every day, and in the flesh of the fish that anglers are catching and eating. In short, these chemicals are pretty much everywhere. And as Representative Sandell noted, they're known as forever chemicals. These are chemicals that were prized for that very characteristic, that they did not break down in the environment, that they repelled water and grease. And because of their ubiquity and because of their persistence in the environment, PFOA and PFOS are no longer produced in the United States. But we're just now beginning to understand how these chemicals affect our health. The US EPA says that, quote, elevated concentrations of PFOS and PFOA in human blood have been linked to a number of potential health effects, including immunotoxicity, decreased sperm count, low birth weight, thyroid disease, and high cholesterol. And PFCs have also been associated with endocrine disruption and cancer in animal studies. And we're learning more about these chemicals every day. In 2019, the state of Minnesota executed an $850 million settlement with 3M to address the cost of perfluorochemical pollution in the East Metro. And only time will tell whether this is going to be sufficient to actually cover the costs to government to replace contaminated water supplies. Now, that's just part of the picture. And these chemicals also bioaccumulate in fish and human beings, since it takes a long time for PFOA and PFOS to leave the body. And since these compounds persist for a very long time in the environment, it's extremely important for the state of Minnesota to have a full understanding of the health risks and a full set of tools to address PFOA and PFOS contamination of our groundwater in our lakes and streams. And that's why MCA supports this bill. Appropriating funds to establish water quality standards for PFOA and PFOS will allow the MPCA to create science-based standards to evaluate the health of our waterways. Having a water quality standard in place for PFOA and PFOS will allow the designation of impaired waters and more tools to deal with pollution and mandate cleanup. Rulemaking is also a process that ensures that the best peer-reviewed science is used and that the public is engaged in this process. As of 2018, 33 lakes and streams in Minnesota had fish consumption advisories for PFOS, specifically for pregnant women and children under the age of 15. The majority of these are in Hennepin, Ramsey, Washington, and Dakota counties, but there are also lakes in St. Louis County and Olmsted County that are listed. MPCA is already contemplating the development of water quality standards for PFOS. On the MPCA's document inventory of water quality standards projects, their triennial review, as of December 2019, it states that, quote, MPCA plans to develop a water quality standard for PFOS in fish tissue to address an expected increase in the number of water bodies in which fish have been impacted by PFOS. But this rulemaking is listed under tracking and evaluation, which is a category of rulemaking that's not active at this time. And the hope is by providing the resources to jumpstart this process, we can speed the adoption of needed standards to protect human health and the environment. Chair Purcell, members of the committee, Minnesota has one of the most extensive perfluorochemical pollution problems in the United States. Really, we were the place where this all came about. Research shows that a threat to human health at very low levels of exposure for these chemicals. Since Minnesota is at the epicenter of this pollution crisis, we should also be leading in establishing science-based standards to address it. Thank you for your time and attention today, and I would be very happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Clemson. Do we have a couple more testifiers? I have on my notes here that we do.
There are other individuals who would like to speak of the bill. Yes, sir. Yes,
let's do all the testifiers, and then we can bring you back up if there's questions for the testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the manager of the water assessment section at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. My section includes the group that develops water quality standards. So I just wanted to speak briefly to this bill. As the previous testifier noted, MPCA has been starting to consider what we need to do in terms of water quality standards for PFAS chemicals broadly, whether that be individually or as a class. And I think that the science exists, particularly in some of the work that we have done in Minnesota at our Department of Health, to do these water quality standards for PFAS and PFOA for drinking water and for fish tissue, which are some of the main pathways of human health exposure to these chemicals. I will note that we do have some concerns with the legislative directive. I think we have existing authority to do those. We are considering these rules under existing authority. The legislative directive starts a clock under Minnesota Statute 14.125, which requires us to propose the rule within 18 months or the authority to do so expires. And I noticed the A1 does also have a deadline. So while we have been considering these rules and are interested in doing them, I think I have some concerns about the deadline because of the length of time that it does take to do the rulemaking process. These rules would, because they would set new numeric standards, would be required to go through the peer review process that's laid out in statute, which takes some time. We've done it once, and it does, you know, take months to get the peer reviewers lined up to go through the peer review process to have them look at the technical documents and to respond to those comments. In addition, this rulemaking would likely be controversial due to factors related to implementation, which always then makes the time frame a little bit longer. And as the testifier noted, just for you to recall that creating a water quality standard creates long-term implementation needs for monitoring, assessment, and impaired waters, and also for permitting and discharge limits to ensure that the standard is met. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, I was going to wait to the end, Representative, but I'll go ahead. Go ahead, Representative Bouguinier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, you have told us about if this is a time-consuming process because there will probably be a contested case. Tell us, give us a date. How long will it take you to do this, being reasonable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bouguinier, you know, I'm not sure that I can be specific about that. You know, rulemakings generally take two to three years. I think 2 years would be very much on the short end. And in terms of the time we need to really develop the technical documents, like I said, I think some of the science is there, but we do need to do more development, and particularly on the fish site, potentially some more collection of data. So I'm not sure I can speak to it, but I would say certainly more than 2 years.
Representative Guinea.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is more than 2 years, but less than 3 years. Certainly, we've heard that the even your own testimony, when you talked about how much data is out there, and I know that PCA has been working on fish tissue since, well, 20 years, I think. So you have
lots of background data going back, I know, 20 years, because we've discussed this for 20 years. So I just am looking at the amendment, and I do think we have to put a date certain in, because the public expects us to get to have outcomes these days, not just a due process and say we're working on it. So I appreciate what you just said, and I'm hearing more than 2 years, but less than three. So I just am clarifying that.
Thank you. Any clarifications on that, Ms. Neuschler?
Mr. Chair, I would just reiterate, you know, my main concern would be the time, the clock that starts under the APA in 14.125, and the potential for the expiration of the authority to do these rules. And that language specifically says then the agency can't use existing authority. So that would just be my concern, that then if we couldn't meet the deadline, it would jeopardize our authority to ever do water quality standards on these particular compounds. And that would be a concern. And I would be willing to go back and think more about a specific timeline and work with the author.
Thank you for your testimony. And I have two others on the list here.
You got more testifiers. I'll wait until they're done.
But okay.
Question would be a question for MPCA.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah. Chair Purcell, committee members, I'm Jenna Grove. I'm here to speak in support of the bill on behalf of Clean Water Action. I think the issue has been addressed pretty well, so I will keep it brief. It's pretty straightforward. These chemicals have been around and used in a plethora of products since the 1940s. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, the chemical industry has long misrepresented the alleged safety of these chemicals. Representative Wagenius mentioned that it's been discussed for 20 years, when in reality, their own studies showing the toxicity of these chemicals dates back to as early as 1950. So the science is there, the data is there. One of the largest epidemiological studies done showed that these chemicals, these two specifically, cause testicular cancer, liver cancer, kidney disease, preeclampsia, birth defects, high cholesterol. The fact that this has no enforceable standard in a state that has settled for over $800 million for the discharge of these chemicals is wild. This bill is a step in the right direction. There needs to be a change. How do you, you know, impart faith in a system, accountability, and allowing an industry with this kind of track record to almost completely self-regulate is wild. So, I mean, absent regulation, it's clear that business is going to continue as usual, and these chemicals that are already persisting in our environment are not going to get any better. So we appreciate Representative Sandel for bringing this bill forward and for the committee giving it time today.
Thank you for your testimony. And I have on my list Commissioner Goth here, but I don't know if we're good. Okay. Representative Lewick, have you for a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this is primarily for MPCA. Do we know what other states are doing? Minnesota usually is ahead on most of these things, but is there other states that are trying to skin the same weasel, so to speak?
And please introduce yourself again, and would you expand a little bit too? I'm going to expand on this Representative Blue's question a little bit about what the health department does have some information, and they don't call them water quality standards, but they're go by a different name. If you'd speak to that just a little bit.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Luke, again, Catherine Neuschler, manager of the Water Assessment Section at the Pollution Control Agency. In terms of, I couldn't give you the exact states off the top of my head, but there is particular interest in several states about doing drinking water standards, particularly in the Northeast, to my knowledge. So yes, there is. This is an issue that's getting a lot of question and a lot of states looking at at timelines to do particularly drinking water standards. In terms of what's going on at the Department of Health, you know, the Department of Health has set PEARLs, health risk limits, and health-based values. Their authority makes those applicable to groundwater. But in our brief, in our some of our review of looking at that, we do think the methods are, they're really about drinking water, and so they're probably pretty generally applicable. And we would be able to look at that, all the health information and the way that MDH has constructed that as we look at what was needed for surface waters that are used for drinking water, which would probably be how we would apply these standards. I think in Minnesota, as Representative Wagenius said earlier, we do have a lot more information on fish tissue and how much PFAS is in fish tissue than many other states. And we have been looking at some of that information as well, and the serum models that MDH has for how ingestion of PFAS impacts people's health, and we'd be able to build on that information for a fish tissue aquatic consumption standard.
And to the testifier, I would assume that what MDH is using, that the peer review science there is using, is peer review science that MPCA could apply.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my understanding, that Lisa would provide a good, strong base for us to start from.
Thank you. Representative Look?
Thank you. Appreciate that. That provides a little more light on the subject. And Representative Sundell, I like deadlines, too. However, it sounds like there's a concern that if you miss that deadline, not these days, but other ones that are in statute, that could derail really set the agency back. Could you lay that out one more time so we understand the consequences of missing a deadline?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative. As you know, when we drafted the bill the first time, there was no deadline on it. And when we discussed it, we thought, well, deadlines are probably helpful. The deadline in the bill that the amendment proposes is 2022. But the bill also says that the money would be available to 2023. Now, it's been a while, but I have spent a lot of time with bacteria and petri dishes, and I know that a hypothesis can change and the direction of experimentation and investigation can change as well. So I appreciate and understand the PCA's suggestions and comments that this is a complicated and difficult issue, but I do feel strongly that we should have ahead of us some guidelines and work toward a deadline. We'll do our best to continue working with the project regardless, but moving ahead quickly is helpful.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that I was speaking to was that in the Administrative Procedures Act in Chapter 14, I believe it's Provision 14.125, and I'm not a lawyer, but I have worked in rulemaking. When the legislature specifically gives a new authority or requires that a rule be made, my understanding is that statute requires that the agency propose the rule, and so that means going through the whole process to preparing the sonar and the technical requirements and drafting the rule within 18 months. And then there's a statement that says if that deadline is missed, the agency's authority expires and they can't use otherwise existing authority. I know occasionally the legislature has chosen to exempt that provision of the statute on certain rulemakings, but that would be my concern, would be the potential for loss of authority that comes through that administrative procedures.
Yeah, well, thank you. I just want to make sure everybody understood that, because at the local level, we often work on a 60-day deadline for issuing a permit, and if you don't have prior agreement, the whole thing blows up and you lose your authority to even issue the permit in some cases. I guess the other thing that I would like to know is, are there other priority areas that you're engaged in rulemaking right now that is going to provide, if this comes in tomorrow, so to speak, what impact is that going to have on the other things that are also priority rulemaking that's going on in the agency?
Ms. Neusman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Luke, as the testifier from MCA noted, you know, every 3 years we do a triennial review and we try to sort of lay out what rules are we actively working on, what rules are coming up next, you know, what rules are we tracking. We have some active ones right now, including starting to think about our drinking water rules, our class one water quality standards, and we have started to consider where PFAS falls in that project. But certainly, you know, were we to have to sort of move this one from the fourth bucket to the first bucket, it would require some, you know, consideration of how we reshuffle our resources.
I guess, and just to wrap it up, I will wrap it up, but I guess that would be very helpful for the committee and the author to know exactly what are we pushing to the back of the line over this, because I know there is a hierarchy there on with what rulemaking goes to the head of the line, and we've got to be careful not to unintentionally delay something else that may be equally critical.
Representative Wiginian.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the testifier, you've talked about drinking water a little bit and the relationship between this standard and a drinking water standard. Would you just expound on that a bit, because both are important?
Ms. Nussler.
Sure. So the water quality standards is built on this idea of beneficial uses, and we designate our waters for what do we want them to be used for, whether that be drinking water, aquatic life and recreation, the consumption of the aquatic fish, irrigation. And so when we think about a standard, you know, a number for a pollutant, that's tied to that use. So there's a different number for water that's going to be used for drinking, for PFAS, than there would be for water that needs to be protected so the fish tissue is at a concentration that people can consume as much fish as they would like to. And so those things are tied together. So we have to look at what those numbers are specifically based on each use. And I think, you know, those two things in particular are linked, the drinking water and the fish tissue, because they're primary areas where people are consuming basically PFAS chemicals into their body, but they would come up with different numbers. So does that help with your question? So those water quality standards go in those kind of lanes.
Representative Wiginius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps a bit, because so many of us drink river water. Quarter of Minnesotans drink surface water. Mm-hmm. My constituents drink the Mississippi River water. And there are, I think, 200 wastewater treatment systems above our intake. Mm-hmm. Some industrial, some, and the same for St. Paul. I mean, our intakes are very close. Mm-hmm. So having a drinking water standard is very important, mm-hmm, for us. And so I'm glad you're talking with health about getting a drinking water standard done as well here. And for the author of the bill, I do see your amendment, and I would hope to offer a friendly amendment just to change the year from 2022 to 2023, and that would certainly accommodate PCA but get the job done.
That means Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Wiginius, I'd certainly accept that friendly amendment.
And Representative Wiginius moves the oral amendment be incorporated. And I would like to ask our health research about, mm-hmm, that's as straightforward as it looks, or do we need to do something different?
Mr. Chair, members, we've already adopted the A1, so I wouldn't be in an incorporation of that amendment, but someone could move to amend the A1.
Well, I would do that.
And let me make sure I understand. So Representative Wiginius moves to amend the A1 amendment for House File 3. No, that's not right, is it? 3423. To replace the date, change the date, and change 2022 to 2023. Any,
we have to move to reconsider.
Did we adopt that amendment?
Say it again. Discussion? I guess it was adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The amendment was adopted. The amendment was adopted, yes. And that, in essence, as I understand it, changes the date. Mr. Chair.
No, let's do it.
Representative Pavin.
I'm going to phone a friend. Ms. Taylor, to your left.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the A1 has been adopted, so it has become part of the bill. So if someone wanted to move an amendment to the A1, then I would suggest on line 1.3, deleting 2022 and inserting 2023. That could take care of the issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, this is not the last stop for this bill. Couldn't this amendment be put on in the Finance Committee? I mean, it's not ready for the floor anyway.
I won't argue with you on that, Representative Anderson. I'd like to take care of it if we can. It seems pretty straightforward to me. If I'm advised that the motion is to amend the A1, I guess my question, do we amend the A1 or do we amend the bill? Because the A1's already on the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, you could say amend the 3423 as amended.
There we go.
We're referencing the A1, the language in the A1.
Somebody smarter than me. There we go. So, Representative Guineas moves to amend.
Yes.
House File 3423 as amended to replace 2022 on line 1.3. No, I'm not going to go. To replace 2022 as the, with 2023.
Yes.
And that's going to be on, do I need to say line? No? Okay. You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Simple little amendment. Beware of them, right? Okay. And I have Representative Ball on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've got a couple of questions, if I may. When we talk about water quality standards, are we talking about a set of standards that would include a certain amount for drinking water and a certain amount for groundwater and a certain amount for surface water? And so we're going to have different standards in theory for each of those three categories?
Mr. Chair and Representative Boa, that's my understanding. In the city of Woodbury, we have 19 wells. 7 have been shut down. In response to the fact that PFAS has risen above the health risk limits established by the Department of Health. This, what we're talking about with water quality standards is a little bit different, and as you described, that may be different from drinking water. What else did you say? I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I just noticed the US EPA has a drinking water health advisory levels of 0.07 micrograms per liter, but that's just for drinking water, and this bill doesn't really specify. It just says water quality standards.
That's right. As I understand it, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has depended, I guess, on EPA to establish national standards, but EPA has been slow to do that. This bill suggests that we're taking the responsibility in establishing those water quality standards. And as I said, Representative Bo, Mr. Clems or someone from PCA might be better able to answer that question than me.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
So
as a toxicologist and such, I know that the perfluorochemicals are a big issue, but When I try to figure out, you know, whether I can go ahead with this bill or not, I need to get a better handle on cost, I guess. It makes me nervous to have a blank check out there with no amounts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Goh. I have asked for a fiscal statement on this, but it hasn't arrived yet.
Okay.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, Representative Sandell, do the new rules that you're proposing affect wastewater treatment facilities?
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, would you say that again, please?
Does this impact, does your bill impact wastewater treatment facilities?
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, that's really an important question. I've had a chance to talk with representatives from the League of Greater Minnesota Cities as well as the League of Cities, and I know that this bill would certainly have an effect on wastewater issues. It's an issue which I hadn't thought of before those individuals came in and talked to me about it. It's one that I'm fascinated and certainly eager to investigate. And before this, before a bill like this would get to finance, I'd want to learn more about that. I know that's a serious issue, and I appreciate the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you know if there's an effective way to remove these materials from the effluent?
Mr. Chair, no. Representative Fabian, I don't. I do know a little bit about the filtration systems that are being considered in Woodbury, but I'm not sure that they would be the same ones which would be effective in with wastewater. I'm sorry.
More to come.
That's right. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Oh, I was just going to clarify that this is a direction to PCA, and they do surface water standards, and we asked about the drinking water that is done by health. So there are two different agencies and they have two different roles here, and it was good to hear that they are talking to each other about how this will go forward.
Very good. No further questions. Everybody has testified that wishes to testify on this bill. Okay. And I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3423, as amended, be referred to the Water Division. That's the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, thanks very much for the opportunity tonight to speak with all the committee members, and thanks to the staff that's helped to support the bill. Thank you, sir.
Representative Hansen, House File 3830. And would you like to move your bill, Representative Hansen?
I would like to move House File 3830 be moved to Environment Finance.
Very good. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3830 is a follow-up from last year. We had quite a discussion on dry cleaner cleanup last year. And at the end of the special session, there was a compromise that had been reached where some funds were appropriated, $600,000 from the to the dry cleaner environment response and reimbursement account to help clean up the backlog for dry cleaner cleanups. That discussion and that legislation provided an additional $600,000 in the second year to be transferred if legislation is enacted in the 2020 legislative session to address the insolvency of the dry cleaner response account. The dry cleaners and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency were to be working during the interim to try to find some type of compromise and a suggestion. And I think you will hear differing accounts of how that occurred in the next few minutes. What this bill does is it frees up that $600,000 to go through dry cleaner cleanup. And then it takes, so that's looking at cleanup. And what the bill does also is looks at prevention, so that after January 1st, 2022, there would not be the use of perchloroethylene as a dry cleaning solvent. And then we would provide money, like we do in other models, as a cost share. Often we do this in agricultural programs, a cost share program, to reimburse dry cleaning facilities who transition out of the use of the solvents. Well, with alternatives to perchloroethylene. So it would reimburse up to 75% of those transition expenses. And there is experience in doing that in the city of Minneapolis, where there was cost share programs to shift off of, for the short term, perk in dry cleaning. So there are a number of testifiers. I believe, Mr. Chair, we'd like to hear from the Dry Cleaners Association first, then the Pollution Control Agency, and then following up from the City of Minneapolis as they just arrived shortly in.
Very good. And the testifiers are here, and I would ask you, we're going long here a little bit. If you could keep your testimony to a couple of minutes, that would be great.
Super brief. No problem.
Mr. Chair, committee. For the record, yeah.
You bet. My name is Keith Owney, and I'm the owner of East Metro Clean and Press out of West St. Paul, Minnesota, and I am also volunteering my time as the president of the Minnesota Cleaners Association. On behalf of the dry cleaning industry of Minnesota, we would like to thank Representative Hansen for support over our very small industry. We look forward to working with Representative Hansen on expanding the funding in this bill so that the remaining PERC cleaners left in the state can transition to non-PERC cleaning equipment without being put in financial jeopardy by the proposed ban on PERC. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Dart Poach, and I own Don's Leather Cleaning on East Lake Street in Minneapolis. And I also do volunteer my time on the Minnesota Cleaners Association, as they all do. Apologize for not the sport coat. My beautiful bride of 45 years is out of town, and I just request that nobody tells her I wore this today. Thank you.
Your secret's safe with us.
Thank you.
You're on camera.
Oh, no. I can't believe it. But anyway, I also thank Representative Hansen with all the help that we've received, and basically here to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. And we'll proceed with the rest of the testifiers, if that's so come on up. Commissioner, introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadalka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I wanted to quickly comment on Section 2 of the bill regarding the transfer allowing from the remediation fund to the dry cleaner account. Our concern with this is that right now the list of folks on the waiting list in the dry cleaner account are not dry cleaner operators, but owners of buildings that had either leased to these facilities. And these companies are property management companies, strip mall owners, and the like. In the cases of these sites, in most of them, the MPCA has not asked for a cleanup to be done. Rather, as they're going through, whether it is a loan or a sale of a property, they're doing this as part of their financial transactions and not because of identified risk to human health and the environment. Our concern is then money would go to these low, no-risk cleanups. Well, the money is being taken from a fund that finances higher-risk cleanups. For instance, those sites where their MPCA has asked for cleanup to be done, and there is no viable party, so the state is the cleanup of last resort. And so our concern here is without changes to the dry cleaner account that help with the overall solvency, we are just repeating the history of putting money into this account and not fixing the problem And what we'd like to do is continue to work with Representative Hansen, the Senate authors, the Dry Cleaners Association, and others on fixes that solve this issue permanently. So one other quick comment in terms of Section 3, just a reminder, too, last year the legislature helped improve the small business loan program, and there's over 400,000 available there, and it has historically been used to help businesses, too, that do make the transition from PERC to other chemicals and dry cleaners. So another option to help out these types of businesses. We want to make folks aware of that. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. I have on the list here, there we go. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair, committee members, my name is Patrick Hanlon. I'm the Director of Environmental Programs at the City of Minneapolis. In 2012, we started a program working with dry cleaners with on a win-win approach to changing away from PERC in the dry cleaning industry. We identified dry cleaners because of the use of PERC. Tetrachloroethylene was a probable carcinogen and known to cause liver and kidney damage. As we did this work, we began sampling and inside the facilities and in surrounding neighborhoods. This gave us data that most agencies don't have on dry cleaning. When we did the sampling, we compared our results to the Minnesota Department of Health health risk values. The health risk value for PERC in a dry cleaner is 20, or the health risk value for PERC, the acute level is 20,000 micrograms. That's an immediate risk to health. When we did sampling in the dry cleaners, we found levels as high as 180,000 micrograms. So the health risk, the immediate health risk value is 20,000. We found as high as 180,000. On average, we found 40,000 micrograms, and that's, you know, dry cleaners that have windows open during a summer day. So we found immediate health risks in these facilities when we were going through. And then in the surrounding neighborhoods, we also found the chronic level for PERC, the same as with TCE. So PERC, PCE, and TCE have 2 micrograms as the chronic level. And you heard that chemical in the news quite a bit. We found over 1,000 micrograms in the neighborhoods, playgrounds, houses surrounding the dry cleaners. And so it was very clear to us that this was an issue. We worked with all of our dry cleaners in Minneapolis using this win-win approach of providing cost-share funding to work with the dry cleaners. And we did use the funds with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the loan program. That loan program on its own is not enough. The costs involved with a dry cleaner and switching away from PERC in their business is enough to, they work on pretty low margins and would be enough to drive these businesses out of business. They're quintessential small business owners. And so the cost share element of this bill and the work that we did in Minneapolis was essential to making that work possible. We became the first city in the country to move away from PERC. And through this action, we could become the first state in the country to move away from PERC. And so I'm hopefully you support this bill that goes along with the funding, so not only the ban, but the funding to help these small businesses make this transition. There are workers right now all over Minnesota that are breathing in harmful amounts of PCE when they go to work every day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanna. One more testifier that is on the list. No? Anybody in the audience looking to testify? Seeing none, do we have questions from members? Okay, I'm sorry, we got a list here. Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a few, but I'll try to speak quickly and clearly. So, to get a rough idea of the size of what we're looking at, how many dry cleaners are out there in Minnesota, for example?
Introduce yourself for the record again, and did you hear the question?
Yep. Mr. Chair, Keith Downey from the Minnesota Cleaners Association. Representative, we feel that there's around 20 to 22 dry cleaners left in the state of Minnesota that currently use PERC in their dry cleaning process.
Okay. So how many are there altogether?
All together throughout the state, we're just under about 100 total.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, thank you. So the ones that have already changed, did they do that on their own dime, or were there other programs available to cover their costs? Or?
Sure. Many of them have done that on their own dime. Over time, as their machines wear out, they'll choose to transition to a newer solvent of choice that would be much more environmentally friendly. I do know that there are several of them that have used loan funds through the Pollution Control Agency and other sources in order to try to help that along.
I'd hate to think that we're rewarding those that drug their feet and took their time as compared to ones that took the initiative and went and did it on their own. So, Mr. Chair. So what other options are out there? Are we just looking at other solvents, and could we discover issues with them down the roadways, or is there other technology that can also help in that regard?
Mr. Ron.
I guess there's several options that dry cleaners have a choice to switch to, different sources. I know that some of the options that are out there as far as like the hydrocarbons, there's potentially issues with those as well down the road, so we do have to be careful on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do recall a company out in the Southwest Metro, gosh, maybe 10 years ago already, was experimenting with carbon dioxide, and you could pressurize it, you could use it as a liquid, and then just depressurize at the end of the process, the dirt would fall to the bottom, you could recapture the gas and repressurize and use it again. Is that one of the options that's out there? I haven't heard anything about that technology for a while now.
Mr. Ronnie.
I'm actually very, very familiar with this, as I was working with doing some analysis on that when I lived down by Le Sueur in the New Prague area. Mm-hmm. I think it was TARP, maybe it's called MVE or something else at this time. They were not able to get the machine to be viable over a long period of time, and I don't believe that there's any CO2 operating dry cleaning facilities most likely in the entire United States, but I could be wrong.
So we are looking at solvents of some sort or another.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
Very good. That's it. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
I pass, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions or comments, closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think this committees in the legislature have heard about this issue for many years. And in the early 90s, the fund was set up. At that time, Representative Bowe, there were about 300 dry cleaners, and now there's less than 100. So we have a problem. We have a problem that we have fewer people to pay into a fund to pay for the cleanup costs. So we struggled to deal with this last year. I think we made some progress, but what this bill does is it deals again with cleanup, but also with a prevention component and a transition to reach to that, so we're not having that same continuing contamination occur. I'm hopeful that we could come to some type of problem-solving conclusion here of this, so these folks aren't back year after year trying to resolve it. We tried to have that happen with finding a solution to the fee issue, but I think the issue is more than just the fee issue and the fund. The issue is the contaminant. And so this bill is an attempt to try to solve the issue with PERC and dry cleaning in the state of Minnesota, and I would ask for your support.
With that, Chair Hansen renews his motion of the House File 3830 be referred to Environment Natural Resource Finance Division. You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Welcome to the committee, and Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr.
Would
Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File 3643 be referred to Judiciary.
Very good. And please tell us about your bill.
Sure thing. So House File 3643 is a modest increase in the civil penalties for violations of certain invasive species laws. You can see in the House research summary kind of goes into the dollar amounts. So yeah, this small increase is necessary to bring these laws into parity with game and fish laws and to hopefully create a more meaningful deterrent to violations that threaten our waters. When the aquatic invasive species laws were first put into place, the penalties for violation were set pretty low, especially in comparison to the game and fish laws. Because it was kind of a new area and time was necessary to educate the public about the issues related to the threat. And, you know, while we understood that it was prudent and in the public interest to work to prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species, we didn't have the data that we needed to understand exactly what the impacts might be of these species on our lakes and waters. So this bill just sort of updates, again, the penalties associated with violations in light of the information that we've learned since the laws were introduced. And I would like my testifier to offer a few thoughts.
Very good. Introduce yourself for the record, please, and proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster. I'm with Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. And the fines were last set, I believe, in 2012. And there's been a lot of data that's come in since then as the impact of AIS, sort of the severity and the cost associated. Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center last year published a study showing a 25% reduction in walleye growth following zebra mussels and spiny water flea infestation into a water body. The cost of managing current infestations of AIS run into the millions every year. For instance, Lake Coronis is spending $200,000 a year to keep an access open and treat the mouth of a river. Minnesota Sea Grant reports that zebra mussels alone cost the U.S. economy $1 billion a year. St. Paul maintenance crews at the regional water utility battling zebra mussels in Badness, Pleasant, and Sucker Lakes are forced to scrape the screens on the utility's water supply lines as often as twice a week. Once a year, the crews have to crawl a half a mile into a large water delivery pipe to do similar work. This has added about $140,000 a year to the utility's costs. So the idea is that the fines start to reflect sort of the severity and the costs of what these animals and plants can do. And for comparison, if you illegally take a muskie, it's $1,000. If you illegally transport AIS into a lake, which like zebra mussels, which require hundreds of thousands of dollars investment, you know, for St. Paul every year, it just seems like there should be some parity.
Very good, thank you. And are there other testifiers? I have another person on the list here. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record. Proceed.
Good evening, Chair Purcell and committee members. I'm Tom Watson from Pine River, Minnesota. You may be familiar with that on Highway 371, Mr. Chairman.
Very, thank you.
Just for the record, so you have some idea of my perspective, we're very supportive of this bill. And who are we? I'm a member, Director Emeritus, and past president of the Whitefish Property Owners Association up in Crow Wing County, one of the largest lake association membership groups, 1,200 members. I'm also a director of the Minnesota Coalition of Lake Associations, which is a group we organized about 7 years ago or 8 years ago in having a voice among lake associations collectively. And it started with a group in Crow Wing County ourselves and the folks in Hubbard County, Park Rapids. And I'm also a member of the advisory committee at MACIRC at the university, who's doing fabulous work on this whole business of AIS. As I said, we're very supportive of this particular bill, and that's both Mincola and WAPOA. Your assistant is handing out a letter that our president, Joe Schneider, sent to the committee yesterday, and not sure it got distributed on such short notice, so here's a copy of that. I want to just comment on this whole business of AIS and this fine program from a little different perspective and certainly supportive of exactly what Representative Gomez referred to. Water quality is the name of the game in Minnesota, as we know. We go to the lake, we go north, we do all these kinds of things. And the second comment I want to make is related to the impact on the economy of Minnesota. This particular bill, when I started looking at it yesterday and this morning, the first thought that crossed my mind is this is a benefit-cost discussion. Minnesota, across the state, benefits substantially by the water quality we have in Minnesota, which is a destination for people to vacation, to camp, to fish, to snowmobile, have second homes, have weddings, etc. The University of Minnesota did a research piece. They do it about every 10 years at the Tourism Center and the Extension Service. And I took a look because it was very striking to me. If you look at tourism spending, that includes second homeowners, in four counties, Hubbard, Cass, Crow Wing, and Aiken County, the spending of people who visit the area is very close to $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year. Translates also into in excess of $250,000 of property tax, income tax, and sales tax revenue to the state of Minnesota. The critical thing on the second document I gave you, which is an Excel spreadsheet, take a look at the line that refers to non-resident seasonal rec property. On the far right-hand side, you'll notice a number that looks like 40%. And if you go down the document just a little bit further, you'll find a commercial seasonal rec commercial, which is 1.4%. In other words, over 40% of the revenue collected in those four counties on property tax comes from seasonal rec property. You know where parts of the seasonal rec tax goes to Minnesota. It goes into the school fund to get redistributed to school districts on an equity basis across the state. This is just these four counties. The other thing that's very interesting, Mr. Chairman, is these four counties, when you take that $26 million of property value and the spending of $1 billion, as researched by the university, it's only exceeded by Hennepin and Ramsey County. And we don't have any pro sports, last I checked, in North Central Minnesota. I don't think the Wild exists, the Twins, etc. So we don't have that benefit. Two other things I would just share with you. Number one, we know the AIS that we have in Minnesota, and we all talk about the four species, zebra mussels, starry stonewort, which is the new one, in Beltrami County, Mr. Chairman, you have a few of those. Eurasian milfoil and spiny waterfly. The thing that's important to note when my colleague, Mr. Forrester, referred to incidents, in the lakes in which they've just done this research to indicate the smaller size of walleyes and yellow perch, 9 of those 10 lakes have only one of those species in it. There's only one lake that actually has both spiny water flea and zebra mussels, and that's Mille Lacs. And consequently, when one of the criteria of this penalty is we have a small population of people, most of the people comply with the law. I've been a volunteer inspector at our lake, and we have 8 public accesses on our lake system. Most people comply. What we've got is a few guys with a $75,000 boat that are in a hurry to go somewhere, and they get launched at 6 a.m. in the morning before we have an inspector. They show up and tell us they're not interested in having us look to find out if the plug's in the boat, if there's water in the ballast, if they've got weeds hanging off the back or anything of the sort. They don't want any part of that. And in fact, I've had one say to me just 2 years ago, keep your fingers off my boat, give me a fine, and come back tomorrow and Sunday, and you can triple it, and I'll pay it. We need to increase the penalty a little bit, and that's what this bill does. It creates an incentive for that small population that simply chooses not to do the thing we're doing. In Minnesota, I look at our incentive systems are very strong for people to enjoy water and recreation and all those kinds of things. But we do need to have penalties for those that choose to ignore it. And that's what this bill does, and I would encourage you very much to support it.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have questions from members? Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one question for the bill's author, I guess, would be, where's the DNR on this? Did you consult with them as far as why some of these doubled and some didn't?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lewick. The DNR couldn't be present at the hearing today, but are in support of the bill, and we did consult with them about the fees to set them at what we thought was an appropriate level.
Just had a follow-up. Where do these dollars go? How are they reachable? And that's probably for our research staff over there.
I reckon they go where they go now, you know.
But I would assume, but I want to make a point that
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, I'm anticipating that question. I pulled the book out. You're looking at the bill amend subdivision 5. Subdivision 7 says that they go to the commissioner of DNR and go to the invasive species account if they're issued by an enforcement officer for DNR. Otherwise, it goes to the treasury of the unit of government employing the officer who issued the civil citation.
Yeah, thank you. And Mr. Chair, the point I want to make is that we want to make sure that money gets back down to the local level, the county level, because that's where, as Mr. Watson said, that's where all the hard work is being done to try to hold this stuff at bay. I want to thank particularly you and your wife up there for coming down and testifying, because we've been slugging away on this one for a long time in our particular area of Minnesota.
Representative Bolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me to understand the infrastructure that's in place now. Do the inspectors have the ability to issue citations and then payment is made later? How does that work if they discover a situation that is a violation at a boat launch?
We actually have, Mr. Chair and committee members, that's a very good question. We actually have three forms of enforcement, or four if you want to go as far as law enforcement. We have a number of volunteers like myself. We have to go through annual training to learn the nature of the species, what we can do and what we can't do, et cetera. I have to, as a volunteer, I have to approach a boat owner and ask if I can inspect their boat. I can ask the question of where they've been, where they're going, et cetera, et cetera. I will tell you, about half the time, most of my encounters have been educational. In other words, they got a jet ski, and the question is, I say, have the plugs out of your jet ski? And they say, plugs? Where do I find the plugs? They don't even know what a wrench is. So we have to spend a little time doing that. Second is, there's a level one inspector who's much like myself. In other words, you have no enforcement authority. You can only ask permission to inspect and look at the boat and do those kinds of things. There's a level two who does have the ability to issue fines. And then in most cases, all of us have a contact with water patrol, sheriff, local law enforcement, et cetera, when we get the belligerent one that chooses not to cooperate.
Thank you. Representative Fabian. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, to the testifier, I hope the situation you mentioned about the person saying, find me today, find me tomorrow, is an exception and not a rule. And you brought up the topic of education. As we raise these fines, do we still need more education of the people that honestly don't know where the plug is, or do we just, is that with a bigger fine? Is that the total answer, do you think?
Mr. Chair and committee, that's a very good question, one we ponder a lot. I would say you're talking about two different audiences. In other words, there is the exception of the one I indicated. I've been doing this a long time, and I can say that probably I've seen 10 in 5 years. In terms of the educational question, that comes it's very, very common. What's zebra mussel look like? What's this thing called a villager? No, it's a villager. What is it? Et cetera. And they want to know those things. And so we have some very good materials we can provide. I particularly enjoy seeing a couple show up with young children and turning into an educational moment with a few handouts and say, would you take these home and explain them to Mom and Dad when you get there?
Mr. Chair, members of the Please. Committee, I would also add that a ticket is education. You know?
Very good.
And typically the DNR writes more warnings than tickets. But they track the warnings and typically only give a ticket if it's egregious or there's been multiple warnings in the past. So really that's, you know, I mean, it's been all over the media. There's tons of effort to educate. So this is kind of the final education piece.
Thank you. Representative Gomez, do you have some closing comments for us?
Just my thanks to the committee. You know, despite what my testifier said, I've learned a lot in the tax committee. One thing is that apparently in Roseau County in northwestern Minnesota, there's some pretty amazing youth hockey happening there. So might not be professional sports, but there's still a lot to attract folks up there. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate it.
And with that, Representative Gomez renews your motion. House File 3643 be referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
Aye.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.